Well, I think we might as well get going. I must apologise for the fact that we're starting a little late. And the reason for that is quite simply, is that we've managed to persuade Tom Carney, who's our visiting speaker today, to change his topic at the not only the 11th hour, but 20 minutes after the 11th hour. And originally he was going to speak on a revolution in interpersonal communications, but it's... I tried to prevail upon him the idea that there's a very strong interest in the social history of communications in the department, Tom. And for this reason, he sat in my office, I gave him 15 minutes to write out a presentation on the social history of communication. But in a sense, the onus for the whole thing lies on me. I'll take part of the responsibility anyway. Just a few words before I turn it over to you, Tom, is that in this department, most of the people have come from disciplines other than communication, and in every respect, when we start talking with each other, we discover that there has been a basic dissatisfaction with the conception of the discipline from which we've come with respect to communications. We saw this earlier when Bill Melody was talking about the limitations of trying to deal with communications within the traditional discipline of economics or political economy. And we've seen the same kind of theme come out in each presentation. And for the first time, we have a man who has been trained as an historian and who has an extremely strong interest in communication, and an interest which obviously couldn't be fulfilled within the normal constraints that are imposed upon people who think that history is no more than speculative discourse on documents. And in some respects, in most history departments, that's exactly what it is. Okay, so Tom is coming out of that kind of background with a very strong interest in communications, and more particularly in the history of communications, and he's, as we'll see, he's published in this area. How's the background? Just a quick word. He was a lecturer in classics at Victoria University in Wellington, senior lecturer and head of the department, then professor of classics, University College of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. That was 57-59. Associate professor in charge of ancient history, University of Sydney, 1962-66. Associate professor in classics, okay, in history, University of Manitoba, where he's presently serving. I won't go through all of his publications because they extend, they're a mile long. But perhaps for our own particular interests, I'd just like to bring out a couple of things that Bill Melody prepared for the announcement. And that is that he has two books, recent books, which should be of great interest to us. One is Fable to Cable, and From Newsprint to Printout. And with that, apology, Tom, for springing this on you at the last minute, and knowing that you're going to be operating under very, you know, difficult constraints, we'll sweat with you rather than fight with you.
Thank you very kindly. The thing is, back in my home base, what everyone's interested in is the various things that are going on inside different group activities, and I have a lot of interest in this and a great deal of pressure on me to produce in this general area. And I'm particularly fond of the social history of communications thing which I have evolved, but there nobody seems to pay much attention to this, and I just assumed I was coming into a similar situation. It began gradually to dawn on me that this was not so. We now have what I hope will be rather more than the semblance of a lecture, but was prepared with some haste. What I thought I'd do would be to look at the earlier stages of this process, because these will probably be rather less familiar to you than the later ones. Let me give you a brief outline of my framework of reference in treating the social history of communication. I look at it's the social history of communications in the West, let me say. And I look at essentially six stages, seven maybe. First is of the pre-script cultures, the cultures which have no writing. and what this does to the whole business of handling one's culture, and how to be carried in the head of the people with these huge, capacious memories. Then the first set of script, I have all kinds of incredible diagrams, which I could have put on this wretched things if I... the syllabary, the people who built those pyramids and ziggurats and so on and so forth, operated with syllabaries. And these themselves had a very interesting series of consequences on the kinds of things they could do. Right. The next stage was alphabet. And alphabet brings a whole new dimension into the kinds of thinking that are possible. It changes not only the language, but the kinds of end products of language. And then you'll see a movement. You can look at the early alphabet and the late high manuscript culture of the Middle Ages. And what happens when Gutenberg comes with the printing press. So I'm going to go as far as early print today. I'm not going to look at high print culture of the 19th century, the one mass medium of the high-speed press and newspaper and so on, nor the multimedia of the 20th century. These should be, you know, quite well written, won't need comment on. The early ones, then, I'll go through. I'd like to start off with this business of these tribal cultures. The easiest way of getting a sort of entry point is to imagine yourself in a culture in which there is no money, there's no property, there are no laws, and there are no states. How then do you manage this whole business of instrumental exchange? When somebody has something that you want and you've got something to exchange for it, how do you go about doing this? And there's a diagram they use to show this. They, in this case, is the economic anthropologists. What they're looking at is what they call reciprocity. And imagine this is your familial group, this is your village, this is your tribe, and that's everybody outside. Now, inside the family, full reciprocity prevails. That is to say, if any of your kins, if any of your family ask you for something, you give it them without any regard. You cannot need similarly ask them for things. Inside your village, people ask you for things, you give it them with a little regard. You expect that there will be some quid pro quo, some return within an expectable period of time. Inside the tribe, again, any tribesman has the right to make a request of you, and you must respond and provide these things. But you expect a return. So this is the balanced reciprocity. Outside the tribe, what they call negative reciprocity prevails. That is, anything goes. You can lie, steal, kill, and so on. You're a good tribesman because you're ripping off the outsider. But what if it is another tribe that you wish to make exchanges with? Well, what you do is you establish what is known as a lien. That's to say, your guy lays a gift on the other guy. The chief of your tribe will present some form of gift to the chief of another tribe, and that puts him into a gift friendship relationship with you. And you become, as it were, kin, so that his men will escort your people through his tribal lands in safety. Now, this is how, in fact, crucial exchanges of essential commodities like women are handled. When you need fresh blood in the system, you trade yours for theirs, and so on and so forth. Only certain things, anyway, can be haggled over. You can't haggle over food, because this is the lifeblood of life, and that's the real effective money at these stages. But you can...
How can you say that a woman is a commodity in a society which is a non-commodity society?
Commodity is not a good word. This is something that you need, that someone else has, and it's valuable to them, so you'll have to make some sort of arrangements to get it. I'm sorry, the commodity
is
not
very important, and should be fairly used, especially in that context.
Right. Now, if you look at the kinds of things that you find in their literature, what you will find in their literature is... Now, what we've got, of course, these epic poems, which were written down with an alphabet at a later point. But they, as it were, freeze the behaviours that you'll get in societies of this kind. We're looking at our people in the West, earlier people. You will get long discussions in these epics of the parentage of the hero. It's very important that he's a child of a lineage. Very important that he be related to this. You are everything if you are in a tribe. You are nothing if you are not in a tribe. And there'll be these gifts and gift friends. You'll get heroes stopping in battle because they recognize someone else as the son of someone with whom your father has a gift-friend relationship. Or you'll get heroes exchanging weapons. And this establishes a bond between them. And then they will not fight, because although they're on opposite sides, they've done this kind of thing. You get this whole business of the whole flighting. Any kind of behavior that deals negatively, if you want to put it that way, with the tribe with which you are not on good relations, is laudable within your tribe. And this is a world of warriors and wizards and bards. And so there's quite a lot of emphasis on warrior-like qualities. And in fact, when we look at the dead in the barrels, the guys who led them were bigger. The guys weighing 15 stones, it's 200 pounds, and got a lot of bone damage, evidence of broken limbs. The word good for Homer means good at cracking skulls, good at widowing the warriors' wives of the other side. This kind of thing, no moral quality in it at all. He could be a good thief. So you'll get this flighting where the man will, your champion will get up and speak in the most horrendous and abusive terms and challenging for the other side. This is part of the whole sort of part of what goes into those epics. And the epics are incredible documents. They're of incredible length, and they were held in the head of the bards, the people who could remember these things. They were remembered in rather a different way from the way in which we remember things. So they were remembered in large chunks known as themes. Now, the themes are of different sorts. Some could be of repetitious phrases which fill the line out so you get the rhythm. All of the early literature, of course, is rhymed. It has to be memorizable. And in order to be memorizable, it has to be in these chunks. These people are not word perfect. They've got these themes, some which can be little word runs. Others will be ways of treating a particular type of incident. This is when Norman Parry got into the Balkans in the 20s and was able to take records of the Bulgarian shepherds who could still do this kind of thing. Remember these huge poems. If you went back and took them 10 years later, it was much the same, but the words had slightly changed and the themes might be rearranged in different kind of orders. But the whole of the culture is preserved in the head of the bard. Because there aren't textbooks. The language is of these early cultures is a language which the size of the vocabulary is limited. It is high on action words, on verbs. It's high on words which have a physical connotation of size, externalities. It's very low on abstracts. It's a very sophisticated language. Our assumption is because the culture is not sophisticated in the ways that we are sophisticated, therefore, that's not true. The languages, typically you get what is known as holophrastic. Holophrastic combinations, that everything is put in one word. That you tack prefaces on the front, and you change bits at the end to make different changes in tense and so on and so forth. And you can change the root in the middle. And you get very complicated ideas put all in one enormously long word. Because once you get print shears, you can't have that. You want little interchangeable bits that you can arrange in those print matrices. And what print does to a language is really chop it up It simplifies the language. What are these so-called primitive languages can do, get incredible nuances of shades of meaning across. And you'll see them just getting shed off at different stages in the later process. The kind of thinking that you will get done is essentially, this is the myth-making stage. This is the charter myth of the society. Partly they're built into the epics, and it explains how your people came to be where they came to be. The bard also served a purpose. Supposing, the way you organize with your clan, there are various types of clans, but the way you organize for war purposes is by a thing called the conical clan, which really, bring it up board. This is a way to organize all of your resources in the event of warfare with another tribe. So you've got your mythical father figure up here somewhere, and then you've got the major clan groups, and then on further down the line. And these may control three zones in which the tribe operates. Supposing you're at this level, and this guy is the son of the dominant clan leader coming down the line, he is the leader of the clan. And all of these people are his brothers, and all of these people are his uncles, and they're bound into fratries, blood brotherhoods, and these are fighting units. Now, what happens is, this is rather an imperfect system, because it's all right, if somebody on the outside picks on one of these guys, then the whole thing swings into action, and it will defend one of its own. But what if, down here somewhere, this gentleman here kills this gentleman here? Then you've got a blood feud inside the clan. It's very difficult to handle. Also, this young worthy might not be a good man. Good in the sense he can crack a lot of skulls. He might not have bred true to line. Or he might not be good at laying liens on people. He might not have the kind of skills for building, welding the whole of that, the subgroups in a clan together. You might have to bring somebody else in. And here's where the bard, with his elastic memory, came in very handy, because he could then reorganize his memory slightly and account for why these new groups were, after all, really part of you. So the bard is really a very, very important person in this kind of culture. When you move on to the first civilizations, the ones that arise in Mesopotamia and the ones that arise in Egypt, I think Mesopotamia is even earlier than China, you get the first writing systems, and these are ideographs. That is to say, they are pictures which denote sounds, so you can write words. And these are syllabaries. Now, let me tell you what they use them for in the first place. These cultures are all based on a totally different instrumental exchange. It's based on what's known as redistribution. And they operate through things called warehouses. And the warehouse is, you've got a sort of a large estate, as it were. And this takes in all the produce produced by its workforce and stores that produce at the end of the growing season. And then it feeds it out to the workforce across the rest of the year. And if you've been in some of these places, it's just incredible. You know, you go around some of the ruins, say on Crete, where this is an offshoot of one of these magazine complexes, and they've got vases which are nearly as high as this room, and huge. They sink them in the earth, cover them all around with earth, and that's what they store their grain in and so forth during the off season. Now, basically, what they used the syllabaries for was counting stuff in and out of these counting houses. It was a scribe, and he took account of what came in, and then he took account of what went out in the way of being doled out. And he handled the contracts. If someone was given a chunk of land, then, okay, he was the guy that said who got what and what was expected out of this. And if, you read a book on the literature produced by these cultures, and what you hear is, the Gilgamesh epic is number one. Well, in fact, what is produced. We've got hundreds of thousands of these tablets, and they're all washing lists, you know, the things you count into the working count, things you count out. There's only one tablet which has the Gilgamesh epic on it. There is a tiny freak of accident that this has survived at all. Most of the things are these these lists of goods which are processed in and out of the canning houses. The canning houses manage a lot of things. They manage flood control. They're in flood plains. To do that, they've got to be able to compute when the flood is coming, and they do that by having some kind of a system of being able to calculate the risings of the stars and what this portends in when how soon the flood water will be coming after it. Also, they've got to remeasure the land after it's all been inundated, but they're operating with intensive agriculture, not extensive grazing over ranges and this kind of thing. And they do big building operations. Pyramids do pretty big buildings. You've got to handle the logistics of this. You've got to get the people fed. You've got to get them there. You've got to, unless Mr. Daniken is around with some gods, so, you know, you've got to meanwhile feed the labor force and get it to and fro. And this is basically what they're doing with these celebrates. So the incredible thing is, what is produced by these, in inverted commas, poor simple primitives, are these elaborate epics. What is produced when you get writing is lists of goods in and out of these counting houses. There are special arrangements made with the kings. You see, what you do is the tribal chieftains need gifts to lay on their own opposite numbers amongst tribes, so they will trade with you. The trade is very special. What happens is you have an arrangement with one of these kings, with one of these tribal chieftains. You lay some gifts on him, so he becomes the gift friend of the priest-king trader who runs your trading complex. And under this relationship of friendship, you can go out and drop off certain specific things at a certain specific point, and you will get certain specific things in return and bring them back. That's trading. And he will come in to your town, and at a certain point outside the wall, a caravanserai, he will be able to kind of shack up there in safety and go through the similar exchange, or his men will. Again, after gifts have been given to your leaders to establish this training lien. Now, what happens then is the whole of this system can only work if you can do the record keeping. And the record keeping is done via these syllabaries. Now, the syllabaries are rather difficult things to operate with that in a number of ways. If you're operating with the first ones were set up in Mesopotamia, and this is a floodplain, and the most convenient item for writing on is mud. Now, if you try writing on mud, it's kind of difficult. So that's why they have a cuneiform. Cuneus is the Latin for a wedge. So you have a thing which just has a wedge shape. It's like a triangle at the bottom. But the edges are beveled. So you put it in, you can turn it over and pull it out without lifting the clay up. So it means you start off with some kind of a picture, and then you have to formalize it to express it in a number of these little wedge shaped things. I have some glorious diagrams of this. And this rapidly leads to a stylization of the language. Now, typically what the people are writing is just lists. And what the scribes have to memorize are these huge long lists of terms. And as they say, a boy's ears are on his back. He learns if you beat him. This is how they taught their scribes. What you would do is you would learn these things, you know, long lists of words. And they even had what I'm erroneously called dictionaries. So if you're at a point, most of this is in the Fertile Crescent, if you're up at a point on the Mediterranean coast there where you're Ugarit, where you're exchanging items with other cultures, then you may have to speak their form of words. In which case, what you've got is a big tablet with six columns of these words, and they're rough equivalences. Very rough, because these syllables, you'll get a thing which will go something like this. But it could be KNG, or it could be K. Or it could be. You know what it is. Because after all, you know, you're handling the stuff that's being counted in and counting out to this counting house. And it's not like a supermarket, there's a limited range of stuff that's coming in and out. So you'll know, given it's on the list, the kind of things that it should be. But the syllabary provides for a very rough approximation. That's why they had all this difficulty in deciphering those many of the documents. They translated this across from a Semitic language into a Greek language. They've taken this across. Then you have lists of things, which are the linchpin for the chap for the cross piece on the chariot. And then there's something about the spokes on the chariot. You get 250 of these, one after the other, that are being counted in. So it's difficult. You know, it's not like a normal piece of language. You can't depend on having verbs every so often and connected words. It's just a list of names. And the syllables that are spelled out they can have different meanings. The same sign can mean different things if it's in a different word. Only the scribe knows. As he has laboriously memorized hundreds of these, and we know from it's been left to us by the Egyptians how difficult it was to get people to memorize these things. You couldn't write then anything that you could say. You could write anything for which a form of symbols have been worked out in your culture and transmitted to other scribes. Now, if you're a scribe in one of these cultures, it is in your interests not to make this too simple, because you're essential, whereas other people aren't. Because in the Mesopotamian areas, there's always people coming across from those highlands or coming across from the deserts and wiping out whoever is in charge. But whoever's in charge, if the redistributive system is to stay in place, you've got to have the guys who can operate it. And the guys who can operate it are the scribes. They're essential no matter who is in charge. So they're not exactly in a tearing rush to simplify the whole of the script. The complication of the script keeps them in their position, because it takes so long to train anybody, and they are essential people. So, you know, whoever is king this year makes no difference. You know, you're still essential. Like Werner von Braun with rockets, or people doing computers, you know. So what you get then is this. This goes on for a long time. It's about 2,000 odd years when they're using these things. And typically, when people borrow these, as the Egyptians, for instance, borrowed them from the people in Mesopotamia, then the borrowing person will simplify it. But over time, what happens? New terms come in. And you keep some of the older ones, so you get a build-up of enormously complicated symbols. Now, the people who basically simplified this down were the Hebrews while they were in captivity. And what they did was, they picked out of all of the symbols that the Egyptians were using. And the Egyptians were using, I think, about between 280 and 300, which is a big improvement over the 600 that the people in Mesopotamia were using at that time. And you had three things. You had pictograms. These were actual little pictures which had initially represented a physical object and then had been stylized down, but had been retained because the scribes had been trained to do it, so you couldn't change it. And then there were disyllabic symbols. It stood for two syllables together. And then there were monosyllabic symbols. And the Hebrews realized there were only 23 or so of these monosyllabic, and they took just that. And they treated these things more or less as consonants. So they would write a word like background without any vowels in it, they wrote this. Now, because there might be different vowels, they would keep a little dot in or something to indicate this is a U sound instead of an O sound. Some Greek happens along and says, hey, great Aristophanes, baby, vowels, you know, put this in, we got an alphabet, right? Only time it was ever invented, just once. And suddenly you get, suddenly it's alphabet. Now, with alphabet, you can write anything you can say. You break it down, you can reduce it into these little bits, and there's got to be a rule, right? Everything is built on a basic, understandable sort of principle. It's all very linear and logical. You write the stuff in lines. There's other stuff you could write downwards, across, across and back, back this way, round in circles. With alphabet, it all goes along straight in lines, this whole linear stuff. And all the words have got to be broken down into a number of basic principles. Any word can be expressed in these 26 letters or whatever it is in the Greek alphabet. And suddenly you start getting a whole different approach to language. Like, who invents grammar and syntax? The Greeks. You couldn't have grammar until you had the Greeks, because you couldn't tell whether the word was correctly spelled or pronounced. It was only a rough approximation. Now it can be right. And now they start inventing various language gadgets, because you're not just writing lists, you're writing, suddenly, genres. You've got everything. You get history, philosophy, the old Greek words, rhetoric, all elaborately developed, and all of this all split up into categories. As soon as you get rhetoric, you get a whole series of different ways of presenting rhetoric. It's typical. It's all of a piece. And somebody comes along with coins. Now, coins are like alphabetical letters, but applied to the exchange system. You don't get coins, believe it or not, until 620. And then it's the Greeks who are with, would you believe, Croesus, you know, as rich as Croesus in Lydia, and that's where you get coins. Now, the thing about coins is, coins are more like colds than, say, pregnancy. You know, with a cold you can have a cold, a bit of a cold, or a lot of cold. And with pregnancy you either are or you aren't. Now, with coins, it varies. There's two things you're looking at. One is monetization and one is marketization. Now, initially, all the coins are stores of value. You've got a lump of silver with a stamp on it, and that indicates it's pure silver, as pure as they can make it, about 96% of it. So you know that that's, you know, you've actually got a little bit of bullion there. Until you've got accountancy systems, until you've got taxation systems, until you've got banking systems, coins only have a very limited kind of meaning. And until you've got token currency in copper to back up the big chunks of silver, you can't really use them. So you can have coins to a greater or less extent. I'm going to make a point later on. You can have books to a greater or lesser extent. In fact, you've got a roll of papyrus. Does not mean to say, well, you've got a book in a sense, but for books you need a whole set of, a book evolves, a whole set of different forms, and also the marketization and the distribution of authors. So you can have books up here. You're almost not, this goes from low to high. You start over there with money or with books, and you can finish up somewhere over here, maybe. What you get is the Greeks are the first people to come through with this whole business of, it's nothing like a modern market system. It's not even like what the economists tell us what a modern market system should be. They've got the whole bit. They have this intensive competitive spirit. Devil take the hindmost. They strip away the tribal blanket. There's all kinds of poverty and so on and so forth. They pull people off the land. They make the land up into real estate. You name it. It goes with this whole business. And coins are rather like the alphabet. It's the same business. You can break anything up into equal bits that can be counted, quantified, arranged, played around with. There's this incredible characteristic they have of imagining that everything can be rationally explained. For instance, if you look at what the people in the Mesopotamian area did with the heavens, they had identified the planets. The planets, of course, Greek word for moving ones. They identified some planets. But what they saw was these, apparently, these odd movements, things vanished. And then there were eclipses. They could even predict eclipses in the sense that they observed periodicity in their data, and they would say another one should be coming up now. But they peopled the heavens with all kinds of beasts. There were things that swallowed stars when the stars went out. And the Greeks said, no, it can't be like that. There's got to be a reason, right? And so somebody says, hey, you know, what's happening is the Earth is turning around. That explains some of the movements. First for this, and quite early on, I mean, much before Aristarchus, somebody's saying, we're going around the sun. This has got to be the easiest way to explain all this stuff. You know, there's no beasts up there changing things around. So then they have the planets moving in circles, and then they have them moving in ellipses, and then they have other planets moving backwards around these things. It's called, to save the phenomena, you explain it in terms, they invent spherical geometry to explain what's going on up there. And they start trying to measure the size of the Earth and the Sun and the Moon by doing kind of spherical geometry with them at different points in time. It's a totally different way of looking at things. McLuhan talks about this, you know, sort of cool, where you step back off and look at the thing and engage in this way. Now, I think that the language changes. The language changes massively once you alphabetize it, because you can make new words up. You can make up words that no one ever thought of before. You can take a word and change its form. And you get the Greeks in the 5th century just spawning abstract nouns by adding otes, O-T-E-S, onto other words. And the Greeks have this very neat thing where they've got a definite article, the. You put a verb at the end, you can stick anything in between, it makes a giant compound noun. They can do incredible things with language with this. So what happens is the language changes, and you get a much greater proportion of abstract terms inside the language than you ever had up to this point in time. The language book changes. The language gets a lot bigger, and the words begin to acquire levels of meaning because, you see, up till this point in time, what happens with the tribal cultures is what they call structural amnesia. That is, whatever you hold in mind, that is it. But when your buds and your memory changes, you've got no record of what went on in the past. Now, once you've got alphabet and you're writing down written records, and you're writing them down, for the Greeks, you inscribe them on tablets and you put them in a public place for everyone to see. You did inscribe things, say, in Mesopotamia. You put these wedge-shaped things, well, you put them on the side of the mountain where no one could see them because only the god was ordained to see. Or you put them on the foundations which you then buried underneath the temple, because only the gods should see them. Now you've got the things out for everyone to see. There's a lot more. You've got books being written in the sense, using papyrus rolls, you've got a lot of information on this. So the language begins to dance them up. You've got records, and words begin to change their meaning over time, and you begin to become aware of this. So that the language changes in a way it didn't before. If you have no script, you also have no fiction, because you know the word is the thing. It's not possible to have this attitude to words with as you have with the alphabet. Okay, you write it down by using these letters. The letters, same letters, could be used to write another word. X used it in that text to mean so and so. Y uses it in this text to mean something else. Clearly, it's all relative. So your attitude to words begins to change once you've got an alphabet. And of course, there are so many more words because you've got a steadily accumulating literature. I should have gone back and pointed out that what you had in the Mesopotamian area were these clay tablets. These, there's plenty of clay. If you bake it, it's almost indestructible. You know, when we were wiped out in the gun wiping out the buffalo, the nuclear attack wiping us out, all we're going to have left is bits of plastic, right? Well, what's left in the Mesopotamian area are these hundreds of thousands of these baked clay tablets. The Egyptians came up with papyrus. It's a water plant which is now pretty well extinct, except I think in the upper waters of the Nile. And you could shred these leaves, pound them out, and layer them one over the other and make a smooth writing surface. And the point about this was that it's light, and it's easy to write on, if expensive. So if you're using papyrus, then you can operate across a bigger area. I mean, transporting a sack full of papyrus is such a chore as to make even our Canadian postal system look efficient. I mean, it just took a long time. So where you're using these clay tablets, then what you get is a series of small city-states, because each has its own central archives and repository and system, and based on that. Now, in Egypt, where you're using papyrus, you get much greater, much more extensive areas you can control, because you can send messages. You can go downstream with the flow, and the Nile, you come back up with the wind following back up after you. Incidentally, it's a bit of a myth that what the Egyptians are all preoccupied about is death. This is just a function of the survival of the records. Because they didn't bury people in good land, the black land they could grow things on. They buried them out in the desert. Whoever was buried out in the desert, it's dry and the stuff survived, right? So what we've got, just in the nature of the survival, is the stuff that went with the dead people. So what we think then was this is a death preoccupied culture. It doesn't seem to be the case if you look at the pictures and things they were drawing. But because that kind of material has survived, the other kind of material that survived on the papyrus was, you'll never guess, text forms, forms of counting stuff in and out of the shreds that survive in the black land, where the damp could get everything rotted down, were the usual kinds of things. But this was meant to be a kind of a link saying that what is important is that as each communication form appears and is more powerful than the previous one, what is important is the group that grows up around it and gets control of it and uses it. So that, okay, you see, as you saw in the period with the syllabaries, as you saw, these warehouse complexes using these syllabaries to do their counting operations. So the next stage, the more powerful stage, is what happens with when you got the alphabetized languages, and you get the age of empires. You don't get empires until you have certain things. You've got to have, oddly enough, the critical things is scribes. You have to have a professional bureaucracy to take the taxes off the laboriously working agricultural worker, stockpile them, and feed them out to your standing army. And you need a road system. You often get the royal post. The royal post does not mean what you might think it means. It means that there are post horses at various stages. The guy gallops and the horse disappears in a froth of lather of sweat and jumps on the next horse. So the message that the king wants getting to him gets there fast. You don't use the royal post. This is just for the king's emissaries. Now, the technique of empire is invented by the Assyrians, perfected by the Persians, and has been with us from ever since, getting more improved in time as the various communication systems improve with it. But it's based on, basically, it's a communications thing. The Assyrians were the first to put together a whole range of stuff. One was, oddly enough, camels and dromedaries. They were the guys that tamed camels and dromedaries, and the whole map of the Near East goes crazy because they can cut across the deserts. Everything alters. And the camel is it can stand cold and it can climb mountains. And the dromedary is the thing that goes fast across deserts. And so with these, you just punch holes right through the map. And so the Assyrians are coming, and it's kind of bad news all around. And they took over papyrus from Egypt, so they could spread over a wider area. They crossed the Asian and the Libyan horses, and got a new kind of horse that you could ride. Up till then, you'd just been driving around in chariots. They put long-distance roads in. The Persians had a road that went for 1,000 miles, and they had a fire system of beacons. Certain simple kinds of messages could be transmitted within a day, just right across, or within a night. They also had a little thing known as the eyes and ears of the king. The eyes of the king are informers who circulate everywhere. Because, after all, most people couldn't read or write, even from the age of the alphabet. And the people who were going around telling stories were not just telling stories to the people in the marketplaces and so on and so forth. They were also passing on friendly bits of information to the imperial network. So these are the eyes, and the ears are the judges. So you've got a universal law laid down by the great king operating over his domains. And this holds the whole place solid. Uniform weights and measures and so on and so forth. And you've got vehicular languages. The people in the Assyrians start using Aramaic. Now, Aramaic, a very interesting language. It was from the simplified Hebraic script, which was in contact with the Greek alphabet, so they used these things called matrices lectiones, these mothers of the language, these little signs to indicate what the missing vowels were. So you could, essentially, you've got an alphabetized Semitic language, easy to learn, easy to keep records with. So the Assyrians ran their empire on Aramaic. And the Aramaic was the language of just these simple trading peoples. But it was the one language that was easy to handle, for everyone to handle. The Persians ran their empire on Aramaic. And then in came the Greeks, and that campaign of Alexander's, only a few years, and put the Greeks high on the hog for 600 years as white settlers in that area. He's ripped everybody off. And the Greek was the vehicular language, and then Mohammed came along and did the same for the Arabs for the next bit. Layered Arabic over it. So, what they put together, they put new types of transportation in the form of horses and camels. They put roads and rapid communication systems. Not in Bhutan, incidentally, until Napoleon's time. Put in a professional scribal bureaucracy. They had a vehicular language. They had the papyri. This is what held the whole thing together. In the great period, in the Mesopotamian areas. Over in Greece, totally different thing. What you've got in Greece is a small people within back of them, people even more crude and brutal and brutalized than they were themselves, and they were, compared with these Assyrians, very culturally deficient. But no one was essentially dominating them. So they used the alphabet in a totally different way. And what they produced is the first democracy. What they've got is a democracy in which you are an idiot, it's their word, if you don't keep informed. And you get informed by participating. You serve on a state galley, for which you're paid. You serve as a state official, for which you're paid. You serve on a jury, for which you're paid. At the height of the Athenian Empire, they were paying between 20 and 30,000 of their own citizens to run their own business. That's what the empire was all about. They subjected other Greeks to keep them free from Persia. They paid the taxes to the Athenians. They ran this giant show. The Parthenon, built by committees like that. And the whole thing alternated with... They had no bureaucracy. Bureaucracy and malaria were Alexander the Great's two gifts to Greece. And he brought them back, the first advertently, from his campaigns in the East. So with the alphabet comes the classical stage of language development. Greek very rapidly develops to being a vocabulary of about 100,000 words. That's pretty big. Latin in its heyday had about 70,000. With an enormously, enormous numbers of abstract words. So you've got the kind of language that you can do things with, and typically now you've got these languages of empire. It's always thought that antiquity is about democracy and so forth. Democracy is not a nice word. Thucydides never uses it. It means the power of the masses. The correct word is politeia, which means the power of the middle class. The Romans used the word res publica, which means something quite different. It means, like, the commonwealth. You look at the state of the joint stock concern, you pay the armies to go out, you support the army goes out and rips off somebody else, and then you get a dividend on what you... It's a totally different approach. This is our ancestors civilizing people, right. Okay, then with the high manuscript culture, what you've got essentially is a dark age of warlords and monks in the Middle Ages, after the decline of Rome in the West. What's going on in Islam is something else. Again, we're looking at the West. You get essentially a kind of schizoid society. For many hundreds of years, the only people who can read and write are those trained by the church. And for the local elites to read and write, they've got to go through church education. It means you, in order to read, you have to learn another language than your own, namely Latin, and then learn to read it. There's no writing in the vernaculars. So what the church does, it controls the language of Latin, it trains people in it. It produces the parchment in which the books are read. These are made in monasteries. It has the best archival system, the Curia, and it sends out bishops, it sends out abbots. It runs the whole with no secular power, but just by dominating the communications net and training all the clerics. You see, who says the Middle Ages is about what we think the Middle Ages is about? It's simply that the clerics are the people who do the writing, and we read the writing and assume that's what the Middle Ages is about. Whereas in fact, if one looks at the Middle Ages, it's all about guys inventing new technologies. This is an important thing. It doesn't surface in the literature because this is the writing of peasants, of mucky-handed workmen. So Latin does not admit the vocabulary of machinery. Besides, the guilds don't want to know anyone to know how machines work. And anyway, you haven't got any way of transmitting pictures of machines because your people are trained to do. You know, in the manuscripts here. Starts off with the letter E and there's all sorts of flowers and things around it. That's what they do. You give them a picture, they do the same, right? And by the time the picture's gone through three transformations, it is just totally unintelligible to anybody. So what you've got is dominating everything is the church, and it imposes this very thin communications overlay. You've heard of social mobilization. My concept is social immobilization, because what is going on at the same time is that in all the local centers, you've got people producing paper, which they take from the Arabs, and you make this in town, so there's lots of rags, and there's water power and so on, and you make paper, a sixth of the cost. You take from the Arabs the language of numbers, concept of zero, and the Indian numbers, actually, they're called Arabic, because the Arabs, anyway, they're called Arabic. So you've got paper, you've got all the technological terms that are in the local vernacular, you've got a language of numbers, so you can do all kinds of counting things, and the church is against usury and so forth, anyway. And you've got these vernaculars, which you've developed a whole new set of terms. So basically, the vernaculars are denatured languages. You don't talk about serious things in a vernacular. Ballads, yes. Love poetry, yes. Everyday business, yes. You know, pass the spud, something like that. Okay, but not the higher language, that's Latin. In fact, if you look at the Middle Ages, what you've got, most people didn't read and write. Very few have read. Far less than in the time of the classical age of Greece or Rome. Because then the Greeks had school teachers, which they maintained at public cost, so that everyone would get to read and write, all boys would get to read and write. And the Greeks invented a tertiary system of education. Plato, the 4th century, added on, he had three levels. He had reading and writing at the primary level, then the grammarian at secondary school level, as we would see it, and then on top of this, the sophists, the philosophers, these sorts of people, teaching you the higher level of information. That kind of thing went when the Roman Empire went down, and replacing it was these backward regions with the warlords, and then the church as an overlay. But gradually, in the various small centres, they've built up people with a new, they're operating with paper, they had a new numbering system, they were interested in trade, these are the low countries and so on. The average person, however, didn't read. What information he got was in the sermons which came in, week out, from the church, were in the images which are all over the church. In the images, we're talking about tarot cards, one of the meetings I was at today. These things, these little cards with symbols on them, which have all sorts of layers of meaning, depending on whether you've been initiated. That same little picture can mean five or six different things. And this is typical of the medieval mind, because it invents vision literature, it invents passion plays, it invents theology, and it invents pictures seen in multi-level terms. These are the new things which appear in communications forms in this time. And what happens is, people get used to seeing a fundamentally ambiguous reality. It's got many levels of meaning. But plagiarize. There is no plagiarism. There's no ownership as yet. You will take somebody else's phrase and use it yourself, because the reader will see, aha, he's taken that phrase from X, who got it from Y, who got it from Z, and look what he's done with it. And as he reads it, he will remember back all of the other usages of this thing, and it's got a multiple level of meaning. Just like the pictures have multiple levels of meaning. And you're in a world, a very strange world. You've got no maps. And besides the languages, there's no national languages. You've just got, between Italy and France, the languages are rather like Italian, dialects rather like Italian, which get more and more like French until they're more and more like old French. And there's a kind of hazy zone between these. There's no maps. And there's no linguistic demarcations. Also, it's really difficult to tell who's in charge, because the man to whom, supposing I'd been born in this period, I would have been working class and I would have been a churl, right? Well, the local guy who runs me, it's also the vassal of his liege lord, who is the vassal of the baron, who is the vassal of the king. Now, who owns this bit of land that I'm working on? Now, it depends, right? Because if the king passes by that way. So it's very difficult to have political identity, because you can't map out the area, as each bit of land has multiple ownership relationships on it. So what with no maps, what with no history, and what with the language in which you are discussing things, either being a vernacular, where you can't discuss intellectual things, or being the language produced by the church, which is all set in terms of mysticism and theology, so that it forces you to express what we would see as social and economic issues in terms of religious issues. So you're seeing things bubbling up, which are obviously regional disparities being settled by war, and it appears as a religious war. Because this is the terms to which the thing is seen. Remember, in their heads, all these pictures they get from the sermons, the pictures in the churches, the pictures on these little cards, and so forth, And these are the images that populate their minds. And it's in terms of these that people will think things. And remember, you've got people circulating through. These are barefoot, wandering mendicant preachers going through at this time, saying that the church is antichrist and should be put down. This is from the 14th century onwards. Now, all you needed was some idiot to come along with a printing press in the middle of this, Gutenberg, and put these, you know, the burning torch firmly in the gunpowder barrel, and wow, because it was all set to go. And the printing press did a lot of very interesting things. Luther was important, not so much because he was Luther, there'd been a lot of guys like Luther before, but he happened to coincide with the printing press, so you couldn't suppress it, right? What he did went out in giant numbers. It was not suppressible. It did not depend on the goodwill of the monks in the scriptoria copying that stuff. In fact, it came out of areas which were not very well socialized by the church and which wished to be independent of the church, which did not wish to have bishops laid on them, abbots laid on them, whose owners did not wish the clerics to have special exemptions from taxation and so on and so forth. So they were prepared to play along with this. It's the difference between Luther and Huss and other people. He has a printing press behind him. And of course, he creates... yes?
Don't you think that's an incredible oversimplification? I mean,
Luther, it's an oversimplification. No, it's not incredible.
Well, I mean, Luther also had a whole bunch of capitalists behind him. He also has a split in the church, east and west.
What have I been saying? What have I been saying? I just said that Luther had behind him a local area which people did not wish have bishops laid on them, abbots laid on them, didn't wish the clergy to have special exemptions and so on and so forth. What these guys are doing is trying to recover a little of that real estate from the church, right? If you wish to call it capitalists, okay. You've also got local interests who wish to have their language made into a reputable language. And what happens with the printing press is what had been vernaculars become national languages. Not overnight exactly, but very rapidly. Dante is praised by his contemporaries for having created the language of Italian. It's inadvertent that he produced some masterworks in process, but what he did, he could have written that equally well in Latin. He chose to write in Italian. And to do that, he retooled Italian to get those ideas across. And you get this happening. Now, of course, what's happened is you've got an elite that can handle Latin, and has access to all of the elaborate terminology that the language has evolved, and that can be simply translated across into the vernacular. So the vernaculars move forward massively at this point with the printing press. The Bible gets translated into German. It's the first. You didn't normally read the Bible.